White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of Henry Ford's The International Jew, on this January 3rd, 2013. Happy New Year to you all. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and...
I'm Hadding Scott.
Well, and we're going to get right down to it, Hadding, because we have some of last week's Chapter 22 to finish, and we discussed after last week's show that since it's kind of difficult to add some time to this show, we need to cut out some of the early chat so we can finish things up, right?
Yes, of course.
Right. Okay, well... we do have some things we have to cover, though, first, and that's that when we, last week, we had a little question about Samuel Montague or Herbert Samuel, and I can't even think of that, Palestinian representative.
International Jew here, it says Sir Samuel Montague was appointed governor of Palestine under the British Mandate, but that's not accurate.
No, you're right. And I looked it up, but I thought I had remembered a Montague in that position. But, you know, that's just kind of general confusion. So, but there was this is an interesting story, though. Samuel Montague was born Montague Samuel in Liverpool. And he, you know, so their family name was Samuel, definitely Jewish. And he switched his name to the first of the last so he could have the last name of Montague. And he was a British banker. And I see they call him a British banker on Wikipedia. He was a Jewish banker who founded his own bank called Samuel Montague and Company. And now he may, considering what we're going to read tonight, he may have wanted to do that to make people more willing to deposit money in his bank, because people, non-Jews, didn't want to give... turn their money over to Jews back in those days. I want to say some things about him because he was, it's interesting, you know, his father was Louis Samuel, a watchmaker, and his mother was Henrietta Israel, daughter of Israel Israel of Bury Street, London. And, then he had a lot of money, so then he got involved with the Liberal Party, and they asked for him to be raised up to Baron when they were in power. So he became first Baron Swathling, this Samuel Montague. And then his second son was Edwin Samuel Montague. And His wife, let's see, second son of, no, Samuel Montague, the one I originally talked about, he married a woman he married the daughter of Louis Cohen. Louis Cohen. So I bet that Louis Cohen was in the banking business, and that's how he got going in it and did so well, and because he doing, you know, he doesn't have any scruples. And so then his son was Edwin Samuel, but he didn't do anything. It was his nephew and Edwin Samuel's cousin, Herbert Samuel, as you were saying last week, who became the first Viscount Samuel and was appointed High Commissioner of Palestine for the British. And now he's interesting, too, because when he went to Oxford, he renounced all religious belief. Probably to make himself more palatable again to the British as being a politician. But he remained a member of the Jewish community, and he kept kosher and the Sabbath, and he said for hygienic reasons.
Yeah.
He did it for hygienic reasons. And when he was appointed to this post in Palestine, it was controversial, and the Zionists welcomed his appointment, but the military government headed by Allenby and Bowles called it highly dangerous, and they said that his policy was subtly designed to reconcile Arabs to the pro-Zionist policy of the British.
Yeah.
So outwardly, he was trying to appear to be totally fair and, you know, unbiased and so on, but they said that he subtly had a policy that would, that brought the Arabs, yes, they do everything, you know, around to their way of thinking and to, so they could get what they wanted. So there you go. There's that family. And that's good in light of what we're going to be reading in this, in the new chapter, because it talks about how they changed their names and so on in order to
hide themselves. I don't think it's accurate that the son of Samuel Montague, Edwin Samuel Montague, didn't do anything. He's got his own Wikipedia entry.
Oh, yeah, right.
I think he was in British politics.
Yes, he was. He was.
And it's interesting that he was an anti-Zionist, while his cousin Herbert Samuel weaseled his way into being the High Commissioner of Palestine, of the Palestine Mandate. And
he was a Zionist, huh?
Edwin Samuel Montague's reasons for being anti-Zionist are very interesting. For one thing, they belie the frequent Jewish claim that Palestine was essentially uninhabited, because Edwin Samuel Montague says, look, if you're going to establish a Jewish state in Palestine, it means driving out a lot of Christians and Muslims. And apparently he was concerned about the public relations problems of that for the Jews.
He also
anticipated that establishing a Jewish state would mean that Jews would be expected to go there.
And he didn't want to go there.
To live as a minority among the Gentiles. So his reasons are interesting. I would recommend anybody to look at that Wikipedia entry on Edwin Samuel Montague.
Okay. Well, we now still have a few chapters from last week's, a few paragraphs, from last week's chapter, Are Jews a Nation? And it leads right into our next chapter, which is Jew versus Non-Jew in New York Finance. So let's just read that and just read right through. Huh, Hedy? Okay. It begins the charge of religious prejudice.
Right. The charge of religious prejudice has always touched the people of civilized countries in a tender spot. Sensing this, the Jewish spokesmen chosen to deal with non-Jews have emphasized the point of religious prejudice. It is therefore a relief to tender and uninstructed minds to learn that Jewish spokesmen themselves have said that the troubles of the Jew have never arisen out of his religion. The Jew is not questioned on account of his religion, but on account of other things which his religion ought to modify. Gentiles know the truth that the Jew is not persecuted on account of his religion. All honest investigators know it. The attempt to shield the Jews under the cover of religion is, therefore, in face of the facts and of their own statements, an unworthy one. I'll just point out here that religious prejudice is particularly objectionable to Freemasons because, like Ford, because the premise of Freemasonry is tolerance of all religions as long as they worship God, and there's an assumption that all religions are essentially the same as long as they all worship God.
Okay. Do you consider Freemasonry and the Illuminati to be the same thing?
Illuminati were Kabbalistic groups from the 1700s that were led by Jews. There were the Frankists. That was one group of Illuminati led by Jacob Frank. And there was Adam Weishaupt's order of the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, it's called. But Weishaupt was a Jew, as I understand.
Yeah.
And also that term Illuminati can also be used as a common noun, just meaning very inspired people.
Yeah, but do you think that the Freemasons were better than the Illuminati? You think they were more acceptable or something, or more mainstream or whatever?
There's a certain amount of murkiness in the history of Freemasonry. I think Freemasonry started out as a Gentile institution, and Jews took it over. Notoriously, the degrees above the third degree are focused on Jewish Kabbalah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that's, we can't get
And
into
the Scottish that. Rite of Freemasonry was apparently created by Jews. It was brought to North America by seven Jews, chief of them Stephen Moran. However, Albert Pike, who was at the head of the American Scottish Rite in the late 19th century, was a different kind of Freemason. Revelo Oliver even says some positive things about him.
Well, okay.
All right. If there were no other evidence, the very evidence which many Jewish readers cite, namely
writers.
The...
Jewish writers.
If there were no other evidence, the very evidence which many Jewish writers cite, namely the instant siding of the Jews with one another upon any and every occasion, would constitute evidence of racial and national solidarity. Whenever these articles have touched the international Jewish financier, hundreds of Jews in the lower walks of life have protested. Touch a Rothschild and the revolutionary Jew from the ghetto utters his protest and accepts the remark as a personal affront to himself. Touch a regular old-line Jewish politician who is using a government office exclusively for the benefit of his fellow Jews as against the best interests of the nation, and the socialist and anti-government Jew comes out in his defense. Most of these Jews, it may be said, have lost a vital touch with the teachings and ceremonials of their religion, but they indicate what their real religion is by their national solidarity.
Right.
This in itself would be interesting, but it becomes important in view of another fact with which the next article will deal, namely the relation between this Jewish nationalism and the nationalism of the peoples among whom the Jews dwell. Well, there goes Ford trying to call the Jews back to their religion again, as if that were...
Well, I don't know. They're pointing out that the Jews have their own nationalism, and it's not the same as the nationalism of the people who they love among. I don't know if that's calling back.
Yeah, in the next to last paragraph there, he bewailed the fact that...
Oh, well, they always say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are not real.
Yeah, well, they want to show that they have respect for their religion. You know, they don't... this is so mainstream-like to respect everybody's religion. And that would be the thing to do, to respect people's religion. Except with the Jews, they use their religion in the same underhanded ways that they do everything. In fact, that's where it comes from. Okay, but we're moving on.
Yeah. Okay, we've got what looks like possibly a newspaper clipping here. It says, special dispatch to the Evening Telegram. A change in the Thanksgiving proclamation. Harrisburg, November 10th. An important change has been made in the Thanksgiving proclamation. In the last paragraph, the words Christian Commonwealth have been altered to read a Commonwealth of Free Men. This change has been made because of animadversions made by prominent Israelites. Governor Hoyt says he used the word Christian in the sense of civilized, and not particularly in a religious sense. Volume 20, American Jewish Historical Society, Documents Regarding the Thanksgiving Proclamation of Governor Hoyt of Pennsylvania, 1880.
Now, if this happened in 1880, in 1880, already these prominent Israelites were so influential in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, that the governor had to change the wording in their what was it? Oh, the Thanksgiving Proclamation.
Yeah.
Well, not such a big deal, Thanksgiving Proclamation, but still, you know, that's and this I know the book goes on to chapters later on. I think even in book two, volume two, where they just start in. They started in New York, and they just start in going after things like this, one after another. And sometimes they didn't win that time, the first time, but often they did. Like people have said, just to shut them up, you know, because they make so much noise.
Well, under the 14th Amendment, the Jews have the Constitution on their side in that kind of complaint. Because the 14th Amendment says, in effect, that states can't make laws about religion and freedom of the press and so forth. Before the 14th Amendment, the states could make laws about religion. Before the 14th Amendment, the state of Florida established a seminary called the Seminary West of the Suwannee or something, which is now Florida State University. But I'm sure other states also did this.
Mm-hmm.
It's the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, I hate the 14th Amendment. All right.
That's the same one that means that anybody that can wander across the border and have a baby has a ticket to staying in the United States.
That's right. Awful.
Okay, chapter 23, Jew versus non-Jew. In New York Finance. The Jewish problem in the United States is essentially a city problem. It is characteristic of the Jew to gather in numbers, not where land is open, nor where raw materials are found, but where the greatest number of people abide. This is a noteworthy fact when considered alongside the Jews' claim that the Gentiles have ostracized them. The Jews congregate in their greatest numbers in those places and among those people where they complain they are least wanted. The explanation most frequently given is this: the genius of the Jew is to live off people, not off land, nor off the production of commodities from raw material, but off people. Let other people till the soil. The Jew, if he can, will live off the tiller. Let other people toil at trades and manufacture. The Jew will exploit the fruits of their work. That is his peculiar genius. If this genius be described as parasitic, the term would seem to be justified by a certain fitness. And, of course, apologists for the unregulated free market economy would say that what the Jews are doing with these kinds of things is really symbiosis and not parasitism. Mm-hmm. Okay. Really helping everybody. You just have to understand it correctly, according to people like Milton Friedman. In no other city of the United States can the Jewish problem be studied with greater profit than in the city of New York. There are more Jews in New York than in all Palestine. The communal register of the Jewish Kehillah, or Kahal, of New York sets the population at about 1,527,778. The next largest Jewish community in the world, that of the city of Warsaw, is estimated to have been between 300,000 and 330,000 Jews. About one-fifth as many as we estimate for New York.
That's only from the communal register. Uh-huh. It's not somebody talking.
Okay.
It's a quote from...
it's a communal register of the Jewish Kehillah.
Okay.
If we accept the estimate of the number of Jews in the world as about 14 million, one Jew out of every 10 resides in New York.
Yep.
That's
like little Israel or big Israel. I mean, it's the home of the Jews, really. It's the Jewish national capital, New York City.
Still the biggest Jewish city in the world. Mm-hmm. As a population, the Jews exert more power in New York than they have ever exerted during the Christian era in any place. with the exception of the present Russia, means Bolshevik Russia. The Jewish revolution in Russia was manned from New York. The present Jewish government of Russia was transported almost as a unit from the Lower East Side of New York. The New York ghetto has long since overflowed the Lower East Side. Brownsville, Brooklyn, is a Jewish town with its own language, theaters, and press. The Upper East Side of New York is practically, in large sections, a Jewish ghetto. The prosperous West Side and the middle-class section of the city north of Central Park are practically Jewish. With the exception of one great department store and a few lesser ones, all the large department stores in New York are Jewish. Men and women's ready-to-wear apparel, laundries, furriers, the general run of shopkeeping is practically monopolized by Jews. The legal profession is predominantly Jewish. It is estimated that of the 27,000 newsstands that control the distribution of New York's reading matter, 25,000 are in the hands of Jews.
I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
That really tells you something. That meant that much. Where are the other people? They don't have newsstands, I guess.
They must have had
like something like a mafia or something to drive out every other non-Jewish newsstand owner.
I think they do use unfair business practices drive out competition.
Right.
There are 360 synagogues on the east side of New York alone. The New York Kehilla is a very powerful organization whose membership strength is not accurately known. Kehilla just means community, although it can also mean the government of the community.
Right.
It may be described as the Jewish government of that city. It was organized in 1908 as the result of a statement by General Bingham, then police commissioner of New York, that the Jewish population, which then amounted to 600,000, contributed 50% of the criminals of that city. Now, I looked up this General Bingham. His name was General Theodore A. Bingham. And he made that claim that half the criminals of New York City were Jews in an article in North American Review in 1908. And because of the backlash from that article, he retracted the statement later.
Ah, backlash from the Jews.
Yeah.
Ha! Well, that's one thing they do not allow. They never have is to point out that Jews are criminals. We know that.
The Kehilla is the bar before which the authorities must answer for statements or acts touching the Jewish community. Its power is very great, and its methods far-reaching. Politically, while the rest of the country is entertained with the fiction that Tammany Hall rules the politics of New York, the fact is rarely published that the Jews rule Tammany.
Yeah, you know, what did we used to think that who was in charge of Tammany Hall? The Irish or something? Or
I don't know.
You know, I've always heard of Tammany Hall, but I never connected it with Jews. Just with New York politicians, and I don't know what impression I had back when.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe Italians and Irish, but it was really the Jews.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. They tend to run the show any place where they're present in significant numbers. Mm-hmm. But it is not the possession of power that constitutes an indictment of any people. It is their use or misuse of it. And if the fact of power is established, no misuse of it being found, the fact has a commendatory side. If the Jews who flock to New York become American, and if they do not work ceaselessly to twist Americanism into something else, if they strengthen the principles and traditions of America and do not cease to vitiate the one and abolish the other, the judgment upon them must be one of friendship. However, To establish the fact of Jewish power, one need not remain in the ghetto, nor in the mercantile districts. There are higher fields awaiting survey. In Wall Street, the Jewish element is both numerous and powerful, as might be expected of a race which from early days has played an important part in the financial operations of the world. This is not to say, however, that Jewish influence in American financial affairs is paramount. At one time, it threatened to be. But American financiers have always been silently aware of the international Jewish financier and have endeavored quietly to block his game. Time and again, the contest has seemed to turn in favor of the Jew. But when the widespread secret wrestlings of the two powers have been suspended for a moment, it has been found that American finance has maintained its superiority, if only in a slight degree. The Rothschilds were the first to be beaten on American soil. The story of their hidden hand in American finance, politics, and diplomacy is a voluminous one. But even their finesse did not avail against the sterling worth of American business. Not American business as it has come to be known now that thousands of Jews are scattered about the world representing themselves to be American businessmen, although they can scarcely speak English, but American business as represented by the combination of American ability and American conscience. If the reputation of American business has suffered, it is because something other than American methods have been used under the American name. In the New York financial district, Jewish finance makes itself felt through its private banking institutions. As distinct from the great trust companies and banks of deposit, the private banker utilizes his own capital and that of his partners and associates. Jewish finance differs radically from non-Jewish finance in the fact that Jewish bankers are essentially money lenders. They may underwrite great flotations of bond and stock issues for railroad and industrial companies, governments, and municipalities, but these securities are immediately sold to the public. There is a quick money turnover. In other words, it's really the public's money that's at risk.
That is right.
The public carries the bonds. The Jewish financier gets his money. The Jewish banker himself rarely has a permanent interest in the corporations he finances. Non-Jewish bankers usually feel obligated to retain a connection with the enterprises they have financed, in order to assure the investors a proper administration of funds. They feel obligated to contribute to the success of the investments which they handle for other people.
Yeah, well, just quickly, I think, you know, I've learned from this that this is where the idea, how the idea came about, that that the public, the general, you know, middle-class person should be investing in debt and in, you know, become a creditor in bonds and so on, and stock and buy stock in companies and so on. Whereas it used to be these big banks and trust companies would support these things, and they weren't trying to sell it all to the public, I guess. But the Jews come along and they want to sell everything to the public, like you pointed out, and then they, you know, then it's going to say, you know, when there's a downturn, then they have all this cash available to buy stuff cheap. But I was reading today that earlier than this, I suppose, it was the stock market or New York Stock Exchange or things like that was considered disreputable and like gambling. And nobody hardly did it, you know. But they started selling the idea that this was a, I don't know how they did it. I'm sure by that, you know, this is a way for people to make money without working. You know, oh, you know, help in the growth of the economy and so on. And here, you know, be an investor. And it's good to be an investor. That part's all right. But then it got to be more and more speculating. And now people feel like they should jump in there and make money and most of us just lose our shirts, or just come out even after lots of trauma and so on. Oh, we know which things could be done. It's just been a bad thing, and it looks like it's the Jews that got this going too. Anyway.
Yeah, that whole ideal of making a lot of money and not having to work anymore, mm-hmm. is something that the National Socialists attacked. Gottfried Feder specifically attacks it. Mm-hmm. This is not how people should live. They say you should make work a central thing in your life. You should be idealistic about working.
Yes, that's
right. And work for the benefit of your people, not just try to find a way that you can vegetate.
And this all comes from the influence of the Jews.
Seemingly.
And the Jews probably do real well with it, but most people don't. I mean, you know, in good times you can seem to be making lots of money. Isn't this great? But there always comes the bad times and fortunes are lost and so on.
Well, but this kind of thing is connected with the lack of sense of community.
Yeah.
People are trying to get rich really at the expense of other people, because you're speculating, if you succeed, you've succeeded at the expense of other people without creating anything.
Yeah. Well, that's a big main thing. You don't create anything. And that's why the United States doesn't create anything anymore. It turned into the business of the U.S. was finance and not manufacturing. And we got rid of all our manufacturing. Okay.
The Jewish banker keeps his capital liquid. The cash is always in his coffers. This is essential to his position as one who deals in money. And when the inevitable day of financial stress arrives, he profits greatly by the higher value then placed on liquid capital. Far and away, the leading Jewish banking house in Wall Street is that of Kuhn Loeb and Company. The head of this great firm was the late Jacob Schiff, whose associates were his son Mortimer, Otto H. Kahn, Paul M. Warburg, and others who have taken prominent parts both in public life and giant financial operations. Other private Jewish banking houses may be named as follows: Spire and Company, J&W Seligman and Company, Lazard Frere, Ladenburg, Thalmann and Company, Hallgarten and Company, Knaut, Nachod and Kuhne, Goldman Sachs and Company, as well as others of relatively less prominence. These firms enjoy a high reputation for financial integrity. They are cautious bankers, skillful in their operations, and sometimes brilliant in their financial strategy. There is much control of industry from the financial side, represented by Jewish power in Wall Street, and they have gained a monopoly of many metal markets. Large, prosperous Jewish brokerage houses are on every hand. The further one goes down the line of speculative operations, the more of the Jewish race one finds to be active in the work of company promotions and the marketing of oil and mining stocks. Yet one amazing fact stands out from the mass. There is not, at this writing, a Jewish bank president on Wall Street. That is, a president of a bank of public deposit. Of all the great banks of public deposit and corporation finance, the enormous trust companies whose initial resources often run up to 400 million and whose combined resources approximate many billions.
That was individual resources. Let's see. Enormous trust companies whose individual resources often. Okay. Doesn't make much of a difference.
High-tech says.
Doesn't say individual?
It says combined.
No, that's up before that. Individual resources often run up to 400,
oh, yeah, individual resources.
400 million, whose combined resources, many 400 billions.
Million.
Yeah, sorry.
And whose combined resources approximate many billions.
Yeah.
Not one of them has Jewish management or Jewish officers. Why is this so? Why have the powerful banking families of Wall Street surrounded themselves so carefully with non-Jewish associates. Why has this great dividing line been drawn between members of the Jewish and non-Jewish races in the financial district that manages the financial resources of the nation? Why? The answer to the question is in the custody of the stronger and sounder financial heads of Wall Street. Only here and there one will discover a Jewish director in the boards of some of the lesser banking institutions. The situation may be due merely to a shrewd analysis of the public mind. Rightly or wrongly, the public prefers not to confide its money to an institution under Jewish control. It is true that in certain uptown sections of New York, there are a few banks of a local character which are completely under Jewish management. But even the Jews prefer to deposit their money in banks which are free of Jewish control. The situation may also be the effect of the unfortunate experience which the public has had with Jewish management of banks in the past. Several large failures have served to impress upon the public mind a certain peculiarity which attached to the Jewish element in those failures. The public has not forgotten, among others, the failure of Joseph G. Robin, whose real name was Robinovich. He was an Odessa Jew. In an incredibly short space of time, he built up four large banking institutions in which public money was deposited. He wrecked them all. His failure was most sensational and caused untold suffering. Robinovich's career illustrated very vividly the extent of the gifts and energies of the Jew from Russia, his wonderful facility for building up large concerns through chicanery, and his cowardice and duplicity in the hour of defeat. This banking career ended in a felon's cell. However, one fact of importance, a fact that should be reassuring to the general public, is that the men to whom is entrusted the crucial task of putting to work and keeping at work the financial resources of the United States have hedged themselves about with a non-Jewish wall of great strength and long standing. The effort of Jewish interests to gain control of the stock exchange is also an interesting story, and although the record shows a steady Jewish gain toward the end they desire, it is slow. But there are indications that the relentless persistence for which the Jew is noted will prevail in the end. That is, if stock gambling continues to prove an alluring source of wealth. And of course, that tendency culminated in the crash of 1929.
Mm-hmm.
When the Jews gain control of the stock exchange, they will, for the first time, possess the power to wrest public banking control from the non-Jewish group.
Well, they have done that, I think. But anyway.
Most likely. There is a silent resistance to Jews on the stock exchange also, in virtue of an unwritten law, just as there is in the banking world of Wall Street. And the story of the counter-resistance calls for an historian. It is related by Sereno S. Pratt that in 1792, there was a little office at number 22 Wall Street for the public sale of stocks. A number of men engaged in the business of buying and selling were accustomed to meet near a large buttonwood tree which stood near 68 Wall Street. In 1817, the New York Stock Exchange, about as present constituted, was organized. The stock exchange is a private institution. It is practically a commission club in private hands. It is not incorporated. Its membership is strictly limited to 1,100 men. The information I found is that that's changed since then. in the 50s, they increased the number to 1,300 and something. And my understanding is that today they sell what they call seats in the stock exchange as annual licenses.
But well, I thought you had to buy it from somebody who already had one. I never heard
Well,
that.
That's the way it was when this was written.
No, but I mean, even now, I know. I used to read about people going to buy one. Well, the price changes. I think that's what I was reading about, how you know, a seat was generally, you know, so much money. I mean, they're like $1 million, you know, yeah, to buy one from somebody who has his. But that's the only way you could get them. But you're saying that they're not just, they can't just be selling them willy-nilly. They're not doing that. Anyway, let's go on. We can look that up and talk about that later.
There are only two ways by which an outsider can become owner of a seat on the exchange: by obtaining it from the executor of a deceased member, or by purchasing from a retiring or bankrupt member. These memberships or seats cost at present more than $100,000. About 10 years ago, a seat could be bought for $77,000. The stock exchange is ruled by a governing committee of 40 members. For many years, no Jew was elected to this committee. Of recent years, an occasional Jewish broker has succeeded in being admitted to this upper group, but not often. This position, however, has not been the main objective of Jewish traders. When they secure a sufficient number of seats on the exchange, they will take care of the matter of control in their own well-known way. The two barriers which at present operate to prevent a large inroad of Jews are these. First, a silent resistance on the part of the other members against the admission of Jews, a resistance which is said to date from the earliest formation of this famous trading institution. And second, the restrictions which are placed by the constitution of the stock exchange itself on all applications for membership. The governing committee of 40 has a committee on admissions, which comprises 15 members and which considers all applications for membership. As the membership is fixed at 1,100, and as no new seats are ever sold, a new member can gain entrance only through the transfer of an existing seat. But even such a transfer is under the strict control of the Committee on Admissions, to whose scrutiny the name of the applicant must be submitted, and whose two-thirds approval is necessary to his being seated. But one outstanding characteristic of the Jewish race is its persistence. What it cannot attain this generation, it will attain next. Defeat it today, it does not remain defeated. Its conquerors die, but Jewry goes on, never forgiving, never forgetting, never deviating from its ancient aim of world control in one form or another.
Isn't it interesting that they wrote that, never forgiving, never forgetting,
never forget,
before there was any Holocaust, so that's not where it started.
Yeah, well, he had their number, didn't he?
Yeah.
So, though it would seem impossible that Jewish membership in the stock exchange could increase under these conditions, the plain fact is that it has increased. Slowly but surely, the Jews are gaining numerical power on the floor of the exchange, and they are doing it with a subtlety that is amazing. How do they do it? In the first place, no Jewish member ever transfers his seat to a non-Jew. In times of market dullness, when the prices of seats drop and the demand is not so keen as usual, Jewish bidders offer invariably the highest sums to the seller. Then, in the case of the bankruptcy of a non-Jewish member, the receiver is almost compelled by the demand of creditors to accept the highest bid for the transfer of his membership. And of course, a Jew is always at hand to make the bid as high as necessary. These are the two principal methods by which Jewish membership in the exchange is being increased. Another method, however, is more insidious than all the others combined. It is based on the rather common practice of adopting non-Jewish names, or professing some phase of the Christian faith. The changed name, or as Jews know it, the cover name, is a very potent part of the policy of concealment. In an advertisement on business stationery at the head of a magazine or newspaper article, such names as Smith, Adams, Robin serve as a blind. The stage is flooded with Jewish actors and actresses, but their names are very distinguished Anglo-Saxon. Jewish papers often print jokes based on this habit of changing names. For long-distance dealing, or any business that is carried on unsight and unseen, the name veil is very useful. On this account, many Gentiles would be surprised to learn the extent to which they are involved with Jews, whose names give no indication of Jewishness. And this very system, an old American name coupled with membership in some Christian sect, preferably one of the newer sects, that would be like Baptists or maybe...
Oh, there's a lot like of... That. Yeah.
One of those premillennialist sects has accounted for some membership in the stock exchange, which probably would not otherwise exist. It is interesting to tabulate the growth of Jewish membership as shown by the old directories of the exchange. In the year 1872, with a total of 1,009 members, there were 60 Jews.
In that still seems to be quite a bit for 1872, you know,
yeah,
right away. That's too many already.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was surprised at that. Okay. I'm sorry.
In 1873, the next year, with a total of 1,006 members, the Jewish membership decreased to 49. Wonder what happened.
I don't know.
In 1890, with membership limited to 1,100, there were 87 Jews. In 1893, with the same limit of membership, there were 106 Jews. At the present time, still with the same rigid limitation of membership, there are 276 Jewish members.
So more than double over just, you know, from 1893 till 1920.
Yeah.
And it's been hard doing that.
It is said that the Jewish membership is really somewhat larger than the last figures indicate, owing to the fact that some of the Jewish members bear non-Jewish names and have adopted some phase of the Christian faith and have cut themselves off outwardly, at least, from the Jewish community. That's very likely. The figures show, therefore, that Jewish membership increased from 5 7/8% of the total in 1872 to 25% in 1919. 25% in 1919.
25%. Well, you know, that's way, way... Well, I guess that fits their numbers in New York. Not too badly, you know. Not their numbers nationwide, though.
Yeah. In its reference to the stock exchange under the head of finance, the Jewish Encyclopedia states that Jewish membership is only 128, a little more than 10%. The date of these Jewish statistics is not given. The article quoted has, however, an argumentative as well as an informative purpose. The statement concerning the 10% membership on the exchange is made to call attention to the fact that Jews form at least 20% of the whole population of New York, and much more than that percentage of the business section. The Jewish population of New York City has since increased to 25% of the whole, and the membership on the stock exchange has increased to the same point.
Can you imagine? 25% of the population of the city in New York. God, I didn't know it was that high.
Well, that's 1920. But it has taken 47 years for the Jews to gain that 25% membership. Their control of the exchange at the given rate of progress is only a question of time. In spite of these details, it is probably a fact that the Jewish speculators in the New York financial district greatly outnumber the non-Jewish speculators. Speculation and gambling are known historically as special propensities of the Jewish race. While many Jews patronize non-Jewish firms, the great mass of them follow in the speculative path and the leaders of their race. In Europe, where their financial control is more firmly fixed and of longer standing than here, it is rarely that Jews are caught in a speculative failure. They are sometimes found in speculative scandals, but seldom in any scandal involving losses to themselves. The Goyim lost their money. As a rule, they dabble in Jewish securities, and in Wall Street, one hears many stories concerning the victories or defeats of the Jewish following. Some of the biggest Jewish sensations which ever occurred in the United States, sensations which disclosed by their lurid light the interlocking of Jewish finance, politics, and racial objectives, have been brought to light by occurrences in Wall Street. It is probably the nature of these disclosures which accounts for the strong and silent anti-Jewish resistance which characterizes straight American finance. Meanwhile, to leave the exalted sphere of Wall Street banking and brokerage activities, let us descend to the street level of the curb market in Broad Street. Here, the Jewish brokers flourish in their oil, mining, and stock promotion offices. They are so numerous as to give a Semitic cast to the vicinity, as if it were a quarter in a foreign city. It is true that these concerns are frequently operated under non-Jewish names, but that is merely part of the Jews' consciousness that, in financial matters, whether rightly or wrongly, he is under suspicion. Gentile names carry with them no such handicap. Going still further down the line, in shadier lanes, in semi-hidden offices, what may be seen numerous members of the Jewish race who are identified with no established market which deals in securities. These are the true parasites of the Wall Street environment. They are the camp followers without status. Their work is that of fraudulent stock promotion, and they enter upon it with a zeal and an energy which nothing can dismay. Their purpose is to make money without labor, to get money without giving value, and in this they are immensely successful. It is amazing the number of these men who make immense fortunes. It is equally amazing the continuous crop of unwary, poorly informed, and unsuspecting Gentiles who send their money from all parts of the United States for the worthless bits of paper in which these Jewish parasites deal. It is a most heartless business. It has not even brilliance in its deviltry. It is the old-time shell game in other terms. The operations of these men are mostly conducted by mail or telephone. They deal in sucker lists, and they circulate market letters, by which, under the pretense of giving disinterested advice to investors, they seek to boom their own shady game. These market letters are, of course, innocuous to those who are informed and who can read their fraudulent import between the lines. But they are dangerous to the honest but uninformed minds of tens of thousands of thrifty people.
It's thrifty people they go after. People who save their money, you know.
Well, you gotta get the money where the money is.
Yeah, that's right.
Pursued by detective agencies, watched constantly by the government secret service, exposed by the newspapers, placed on trial in the courts, convicted and sentenced to terms in prison, this type of Jewish swindler is undeterred. Where other men would regard exposure as a lifelong shame, this type regards it simply as a trifling interruption, as a sailor would regard an accidental tumble overboard. And that's symptomatic and consequential of the fact that they're not really part of the community that they've damaged.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own community mm-hmm. that winks at these things.
That's right.
There are lower depths still where bald theft and violence prevail. The persons most found there are the henchmen of the lower type of speculators. The stories of criminality in Wall Street, a numerous and startling list, involving sometimes the high but mostly the low, and all marked with a peculiar racial and groupal cast, have at times challenged the attention of the whole world. But as is usually the case with the general publication of such stories, the fundamental explanatory facts are omitted. The fundamental explanatory facts are omitted. They don't tell you what you need to know. But it will be seen, as the story of actual conditions in Wall Street and its financial environs is unrolled, that there are always the two elements, Jewish and non-Jewish. It is perhaps the only non-Jewish coalition in America, this silent resistance which American finance is making to Semitic control. It is, in a sense, unnatural to the American mind, but has been forced as a defensive against the strong offensive operations of the Semitic coalition. If there is ever in the United States a strong non-Jewish combination, it will be the direct result of the ancient Jewish coalition against non-Jews. The condition in the United States at this moment with regard to the financial question is this. The Jewish coalition goes lower, but it does not yet go higher than non-Jewish control. It is struggling to go higher, but has thus far been stopped. It is believed that when the people are made aware of what is transpiring, it will be forever stopped. That means block.
Yeah, okay, I didn't know why that E was there. But, you know, obviously, again, you know, things didn't go the way that they hoped, that the people were going to wake up and stop it.
Yeah. As readers of former articles will remember, the attack upon capital represented by the disorderly forces who operate under the forged banner of progress is an attack against Gentile capital only. The only financial managers attacked in the United States are Gentile managers. In England also, the same attack is made. Readers of the newspapers know what strenuous efforts are being made in that country to wreck railroad and coal mine administration by a constant series of strikes. But what readers of newspapers are not told is that the railroad and coal mines are still in Gentile hands, and that the Bolshevist-led strike is a Jewish financial weapon to wreck these forms of Gentile business, that they may easily fall into Jewish hands.
Wonderful. We completed it just in time. This was in the 13th November issue of the 1920 Dearborn Independent. Well, Hadding, you want to say anything? We've got 10 seconds.
Well, that bit where he says that the cash always remains in the Jews' coffers, he's basically talking, I think, about partial reserve banking.
Uh-huh. Well, folks, thanks for being with us tonight, and we will be back
next week with the
next chapter. Good night.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.